This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio here on NPR One. Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer reporting from Little Rock, Arkansas. Come along and join me for an interview with Robin White. She's the National Park Service Superintendent at Central High School National Historic Site. And Courtney Bradford, Professor of Black History and Curator at Mosaic Templars Cultural Center. White and Bradford challenge listeners to examine racial inequality through the insightful and at times highly touching experiences of two women who are championing new ways to approach the age-old problem of racism. Together, they discuss the everyday life problems faced by those of color. They dissect the dark roots of intergenerational racism still growing today, detailing effective programs from local to international levels that help unite all people under the human race banner and acknowledge the power of children's fresh-eyed perspectives to make lasting change a reality. They posit that meaningful dialogue between allies to change the status quo, accomplished not just by seeing others for who they are, without prejudging, but by developing soul-to-soul affirmations capable of melting away hate. White and Bradford poignantly affirm the power of every beautiful life coming together as humanity's choir to celebrate each other and promote peace.
My name is Robin White. I'm the superintendent here at Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site here in Little Rock, Arkansas.
You're going to share a poem with us?
Yes. Okay. The poem is titled Beautifully Broken. Tyranny romanticized and massacres normalized. Our ancestors terrorized, and yet we are expected to apologize for being the wrong color at the wrong time. Told little white lies from old white guys sitting skyscraper eye. Legislating subjugation. Democracy dismantled, making racism your heritage. Legally stripping us naked as shame is turned to fame. Our motherland drum speaks for the unheard, muffled voices, the non-essential underclass, the walking contraband. A flame inside the ice, born out of your entitled arrogance. The tumultuous marriage of hate and entitlement breeds oppression. The tumultuous marriage of hate and entitlement breeds oppression. The red dark stains on the tree trunk takes us to a place without sanctuary. Your body crumbled and burned. Your soul-wrenching scream fell on raised ears as the rope grew tighter, stilling your earthly ears. Not one face spoke of shame. With wild eyes and menacing sneers, a joyful noise sounded during the life-taking rain. Our hearts are heavy, can't hold the sight as your face rapidly swell on this aborbit, lonely night. It is 2021, and the stories must be told as the new age lynching becomes the fatal chokehold. Countless senseless deaths and loss of hope. Our people owned by stand your ground laws, juries, and multiple invisible ropes. Still, we stand and find our liberations in concerted generosity in the same proximity. Smuggling love, and again, smuggling love in the land of the free. Continue fighting for democracy. Our children generationally are beautifully broken. Our children generationally are beautifully broken into massive gems and humanitarian activist. We see you as our children continues to rise in academics, leadership, faith activism, environmental and social justice. We stand in our convictions in song and dance to celebrate the beautifully broken, our ancestors. We have to consider those seeds that we would never see grow. You know, we look at a seed create that forest. And every boy, there's a man. And every woman, there's a girl. And when their lives are snuffed out, we are denying their generations to be born. We have just killed generations of people. When we talk about restorative justice and how that can be double standard, whereas you are making amends with one group, that victim, but when the perpetrator comes out, they are still punished because they're denied job opportunity, they're denied housing, they're denied the right to vote, they're denied the right to be a man or a woman because all of their dignity has been stripped from them. And how do we answer that? How do we support our system fully and dismantle what we are faced with today? Because African Americans, the black and brown, we cannot do this. We cannot dismantle a system that we created. We did not create this system. And now we are told if we are to have discussions of race and entitlement and arrogance and privilege, that it is going to be against the law. We cannot talk about our reality. So how can we share with others for them to understand what is really going on? How can we help others to grow in that pod? How can we expose them to the opportunities of who we really are and what we are made of? Perseverance, that's one part of us. We are born from wounded wounds. We are born into generational trauma. Sometimes we don't understand the pain that we are suffering that has lingered on from our ancestors. And if we can't wrap our heads around it, how can we hope for others to understand until we have that dialogue?
Now, my name is Courtney Bradford. I'm the curator of collections at Mosaic Templars Cultural Center in Little Rock. And what Ms. White is speaking on is entitled Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome. Like I said, it's ingrained in us generationally. You can find this in our DNA, the trauma and the effects, and then the things that we do now. And sometimes, unbeknownst to us, we do certain things, and it's because of that trauma.
So it's somewhat unconscious.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And it's because, like you said, it's ingrained in us. And so if my mother did it, and if her mother did it, and if her mother did it, it's in me, even when you try to get away from it. But if you do not know it, if you're not aware that it is inside of you or it's in your DNA or it's in your ancestral line, it is hard to bring that forth if you're in denial or if you're just unknowledgeable of those things. And so that is one thing that we actually do talk about in my introduction to Africa.
That would be a natural topic.
Yes. Yeah. It is a big topic. And what I have found that, you know, so many of my students did not know, but it opened their eyes and their mind to start looking at things and viewing not only their lives and their families and things that are portrayed in the media, things mm-hmm. of that nature, and to kind of see the bigger aspect of that.
Give us some teaching contextual points for the kids that you would bring up.
Mm-hmm. So I teach college students, and so it's very amazing because it's almost as if I'm trying to reteach them. They're having to relearn their history mm-hmm. because it has been taught one way. And so one of the biggest topics I asked them about is like, what is the dangers of whitewashing history? Like, what happens when you do that? And so they often say, you learn one way, and it's not necessarily the truth. And so we bring up Rosa Parks. You know, oftentimes she's thought of just a tired lady who was older, and she was tired that day and didn't want to get out of her seat. In all actuality, she was an activist, and she did so many things.
Right, and she was picked. She was selected.
Yes,
yeah.
She was. She was chosen. And even in that instance, that was not the first time they did something like that. And so it's very interesting to see my students who are on the collegiate level, but I'm actually reteaching them what they should have learned to begin with.
This is Robin White again. There are several methods that we could use. And I talk about mental hygiene. Mm-hmm. How do we step into that mental hygiene when we are constantly apologizing for our existence? Mm-hmm. And that, as far as what this apology is, space occupants apology, as I call it. Mm-hmm. And we apologize for who we are, the color of our skin, the way we talk, for our hair, the way we look. We are constantly made to feel that we need permission for our existence. Mm-hmm. So how do we step beyond that and value ourselves? How do we step and teach children how beautiful they are? Mm-hmm. You know, and even though a lot of us are beautifully broken, mm-hmm. we know that there is a threshold that we can go over that to value ourselves. Mm-hmm. And all of it comes down to self-validation. It mm-hmm. comes down to that. But also recognizing, especially, we are taught to be ashamed of seeking help, mental help. And I always talk about that part is that mental hygiene mm-hmm. and recognizing that something is amiss, that this is not right. I grew up actually going to prison a lot to visit relatives. All the men, I was constantly going to prison just to visit them as a little girl. And then maybe 20 years ago, I said, this is not normal. Mm-hmm. What we're doing is not normal, but it was normal for me. And then it took me to realize that this is not right. Mm-hmm. You know, and I grew up partially in the South and in the North. And so there are two rules. I also, at age 14, was a migrant worker picking grapefruit and oranges in Umatilla, Florida at Golden Gems Camp. So I've been, you know, picking cotton and being in that, you know, you have to move out the way for these good people. And I was always wondering, if they're good people, what does that make me? You know, mm-hmm. where do I fit in mm-hmm. with this? And that part is thinking and processing. And that's what I call mental hygiene. Mm-hmm. And looking at what's going on internally with you mm-hmm. and how we can move beyond that.
I really like that because it reminds me of how I'm raising my son. He's 6 years old, and I'm very conscientious and very intentional on the things that I expose him to. And so a lot of the things, like the books, talk about, you know, being an African-American man, being strong and independent, and how beautiful you are. And one of my favorite books to read to him is All Because You Matter. And it's such a powerful book, and it shows that, you know, regardless of, you know, so those little nuances, like, you can still find that strength within you. And that's one thing, you know, raising a black young man in America, I've been very intentional to see the light in his eyes and to see when we talk about, you know, other African Americans. He loves Langston Hughes. That's one of his favorite people. He'll talk anybody about Langston Hughes. He's 6 years old. And I've been working with him. And I said, the first poem I want you to learn is Dream Deferred. And to hear my son say that is beautiful, because I wanted him to say things, words that were powerful and that would have meaning, and that is instilled in him. So for the mental hygiene, it's just being intentional, being very conscientious of what you're exposing our young people to, so they can grow up into these mentally healthy people, and they can continue to teach our generations. It's just breaking those generational curses by being very intentional.
Yes, and a part of that also is recognizing how society prescribes how we see mm-hmm. each other and how others see us. Mm-hmm. Society, there's a prescription with how we are viewed, mm-hmm. and until we can work with both groups, our allies, for them to understand what is really going on beneath the surface. And we will never reach that threshold of us working together, because you have to understand me, value me. It's the same as with, you know, the police. You can't protect me if you don't value me. Mm-hmm. You can't protect me if you are afraid of mm-hmm. me.
If you don't know me, not
exactly.
familiar with me.
And mm-hmm. we have to see each other in totality and look at each other and see not what society prescribes us to see, mm-hmm. but what you generally see mm-hmm. in that beautiful man, that beautiful boy, that beautiful woman. And a lot of times I have this habit, when I see dark-skinned men, I let them know. I will tell them, you are so beautiful. Mm-hmm. When I see dark-skinned girls, I tell them that you are beautiful. You have to mm-hmm. reiterate that. You have to put that within them and plant those seeds of greatness. Because my granddaughter is by Jamaican, and she's very dark-skinned, and I was calling her beautiful Sasha. So At age 4, people would ask her name, and she said, "Beautiful Sasha." She thought that was her name. But that's that seed I planted in her. Even when others would call her names, and it would hurt her, I would still reiterate that. "You are beautiful, baby." And that's how I come with beautifully broken. That there's a break in all of us. There are bits and pieces of us that hurt. There's a lot of pain within us. And moving through that, we have to work together. It just cannot be one-sided for us to understand each other. So as we move along and try to move beyond what is dictated to us, our allies must do the same. We have to work together to reach that. And so when I was started off at the National Park Service, it was some young children in the fifth grade that was calling me the N-word. And it was then that I decided I was going to stay within this agency, that I had a duty to work with those children, to plant those seeds of greatness with them, and for it to see me in totality.
That's really powerful. You have done special meetings and meetups with people from across society and culture, including police. Are you still doing that, and how? Because that seems an important vehicle.
We have a strong partnership with the FBI. And there is a program they do called The Color of Law. And we host it here. We have headed over to Central High School and had a nice turnout because we invite the community. But I also have brought the FBI together with the American Indian Movement. And there was a little heated discussion. But if we don't bring people together to discuss what is impacting them in a negative way, then we are missing. And this site, we have to deal with conflict, not only at this site, but in the National Park Service. Because we have to look at, even today, and we call that whitewash, our history is still lost, destroyed, forgotten. And we have a responsibility to write our own narratives, to share our own narratives. Although I am the National Park Service, I am still a woman. I am still an African American. I am still Creole. I am still Gullah and Geechee. And they don't dream what I dream. They don't see what I see. And so we have to share with each other to break down those culture barriers. We have to share with each other to break down those social barriers. Mm-hmm. So you can see me and I can see you.
I was just recently in Tampa, Florida, and I was with the mayor, who was a police for 30 years before that. And they have very functional policing. And she said her solution was very simple. It was returning to the old days of community policing, where the community knows the policeman and the policeman knows the community.
I just come to Cincinnati, Ohio. My name is Iris Rowley. And she and the Black United Front, over 10 years ago, introduced collaborative community police and the police. And I've been trying to bring it here for several years, and I am going to actually write some grants to see if we could do that, because we need this in our communities as well. I grew up running from the police. I didn't, no reason, but I know that's what you're supposed to do. I was raised to fear the police, to run from the police. It didn't matter if you were a girl or a boy. When you saw the police coming, you just took off. And that fear was instilled in us, that they didn't value us. And as you grow up, you see it. You see it with all these senseless deaths, the murders. And it's painful, especially when your children and great-grandchildren are encountering what you encountered earlier, and nothing has changed. So we have to look at different methods to build companionship, compassion, partnership, relationship, and communicate and better. But if you are raised in a community that you are taught that Black and brown people are of no value, if this has been put into your psyche, then we have to, and they have to learn the unlearned. They have to start over again and see that we are just a people. And I was in college, and my teacher put a young man and I together to do a project. And when it was our turn, the young man, this is what he said. He said, "I am so angry at my parent. I am so angry at my parent because they taught me that Black people were ignorant They taught me all these negative things. And I worked in just in partnering with Robin, in partnering with me. It's all attitude change, attitude on who we are. And I think that we have to do that. We have to, in breaking down those social barriers, we have to come together. We have to dialogue. And that was the thing I was doing with the American Indian Movement and the FBI. And I brought the FBI in this to do the color of law, but they were also training local police officers as well. And actually, in a few months, they will be doing one for the National Park Service and regional level. But until we have that dialogue and look at how we could break down those barriers, the wall will still be there. Those negative concepts will still be there. Devaluing us will still be there. And not looking at us as a human being. You know, I am not a monster. I am not a monster. My sons are not a monster. So the children in this community, they are just babies. And we have a responsibility to take care of them. And we have a responsibility to invest in the future of our officers and our children, those that are the next generation.
Historically, some of your best successes on a community level have been the programs you put together. I mean, you even brought Northern Ireland IRA people here. You know, we're coming out of COVID, so I know, and you're brainstorming on some future ideas. Give us an idea of what you would like to see happen.
Program at Central High School called the Memory Project. We have young people that actually interview their parents, but they've gone beyond their relatives, talking to people in the community. I would like this to go to on a national level for other national parks. We come out template, so we're working on that. We're looking at that.
Is that plausible that it could happen?
Yes, it is. It is, because this program has been going on over 10 years now. We just need to take it to another level. We're also working with a program called No Tears Sweet, which that is behind you. And in commemoration of the Little Rock Nine, and in particular Melba and Elizabeth Egbert. Well, we have musicians. I've hosted this program in New Orleans, in Fayetteville, in Bentonville, and now we're going to Tulsa, Oklahoma, at the Woody Guthrie Center, and we'll be doing that. And I think that just exposing people to the National Park Service and leave imprint or our footprint across the country on a national and international level, and that's what I really focus on, because in working with the, I would look at them as victims. So they are the descendants in Ireland on a bloody Sunday. They had a bloody Sunday in the 70s, and we had a bloody Sunday. So what I've done was brought us together in sharing that story, that this is not just in one area. This is discrimination. This is across the country. It's just a part of our cultures. So in exposing these youth to Bloody Sunday in Ireland that they knew nothing about, was it a way to break down those social and culture barriers? How do we talk about who we are and then respect other cultures? We have to have those conversations.
Yeah, and it's probably eye-opening that racism and hatred is not limited to one ethnic group.
I would definitely agree, and I'm so glad that you talk about how we want to teach them. Our children's gallery that will be opening in September at Mosaic actually teaches children about the differences that they may have, but also showing how amazing each child is regardless of the differences and what makes them unique. And so we have representations from various ethnic backgrounds, various abilities and disabilities, you know, to show children that, yes, they're all different, but they are the same, but they are unique, and regardless of, they are amazing. And so that's so important, because we do start that talk about race. And from my understanding, we're one of the only museums that actually talks to children about race and how they can interact with their peers. And it allows your family members to also continue to teach the children about race as well. So it's very important. It does start at home, but if we're able to, as public historians, to present this to the public and for them to interact with it and have those discussions, it continues that dialogue as well.
That is very important. And we also have a program, a transportation reimbursement program for the Delta region, and reimburse the schools that
for field trips.
For field trips. Mm-hmm. But also not just coming to our site, go to Mosaic Templars, mm-hmm. or go to Hot Springs. We have 7 national park sites assist in the system here in the state of Arkansas. It's about bringing them in, learning from them what they have been taught, and then engage with them how we could do it differently, how they could do it differently. We have to know what's going on in their head, what they're being taught. So we take advantage of the opportunity, learn from them, and then have those conversations. And it's interesting because we have gotten groups from Turkey, from not only from Ireland, but Iraq, from Pakistan. We have multiple groups come in. And then after they go through, we had one group say to another, that's how you treat us. And we have to go in here and talk, but they're crying. And to me, that crying is a cleansing, but also sharing with their peers is that this is how we feel. And we just step back and let them engage with each other. But also, even with the children coming from the Delta region, we also let them engage with each other as well, because they have to live together in that community. So how do we understand what they're going through unless they're engaging with each other and can support each other?
Both of you, when you look at the little kids, the 6, 7, 8-year-olds, and you try to translate to you in when you were kids, do you see progress?
I think for me personally, it's kind of a different type of question, because I was raised by educators. I was raised by my grandparents who taught at Dunbar while it was segregated. And so I was very much so taught my history because my grandparents lived that history, and they made sure we did not forget. I do see there's an absence, a gap, per se, and I'm not sure if it's because there's so many people who are not sure or not knowledgeable of that history. It has not been presented. And in some aspects, if it's not presented in the classroom, that's the only way they're going to get it. And, you know, like the program, a lot of students in the Delta, from my experience with working with students from the Delta, they can't afford to go to a museum, or it's not important necessarily for parents to stop and say, hey, we're going to go to the museum and learn this lesson today. And so, you have to take the opportunity. I always go back to my son because I'm always watching and seeing what he knows and like what he's learning at school, and then I'm always correcting or at least trying to. Okay, babe, this is how this goes. I know for my son and my niece and my nephew, they will be knowledgeable, and any child that comes across me will be knowledgeable. But there is a lack, and it's simply because it's not taught in schools. And then if the parents don't know, they cannot teach their children. And so having public programming that families can access and they can sit down and teach the story outside of a regular classroom setting is the most important way for them to get that information. But like I said, I'm a little different. I grew up being knowledgeable, but I do see that absence, and I see what's going on with my students. But when they come to my African American Studies class, they literally come seeking it because they have not had it. And they say, I want to learn whatever it is that you have to offer me, because we have not been taught anything at all.
My rearing as a girl child, my parents were sharecroppers, McShann Plantation, and Slater or Slaughter, Mississippi, and Greenwood, Mississippi. So from the south to the north, back to the south, I participated in growing up on that plantation. So as a girl child, I was with a lot of my elders, but they was teaching me more about believing in myself and valuing myself, teaching me more about how to make herbs or oils. I was learning like that. And actually, they didn't reiterate education. And no one talked about my going to college, but they had their ends on me, whereas I was taught other things about surviving, that you encounter this, you keep your eyes lowered, you do this, you do that. And so they were teaching me to survive. And there were a few times that, you know, I got in trouble because I didn't understand. I was going back and forth, things would get confusing, but as I get older, I do understand. So I pick cotton, I pick pecans, and I went to school in the north. I didn't even go to school while I was down in the south. And I stated earlier, being a migrant worker in Umatilla, Florida at Golden Gems Camp, I decided that I was going to go to school. I learned the streets, I learned from my elders, and I decided I was going to go to school. And I went and got my bachelor's Recently, a couple of years back, I got my master's, and I want to get my doctorate in divinity. I feel that we all have a role to play in society, and sometimes we can choose it, or society will choose us, and we all have a path that we must walk, but we cannot shirk from our responsibilities and contributing to the betterment of our society, that we all have a responsibility to our communities. And I feel that in reaching our children, it's our responsibility to teach them so they can be at the decision-making table, making decisions about our future, about their future. So we have a responsibility, actually, to invest. Regardless, we have to plant those seeds. Even if you think they don't hear you, they hear you.
Listening to what you're saying, they are. And so I go back to my son, because I teach African American studies. He recites so much of the things that I say, and he's so, I love Black history, I love this, and just the, even the different figures. I say, oh, he's really watching me. I say, he's watching everything that I'm doing. So I'm like, okay, let me be very conscientious of how I presented myself. And that thing's, I think it's the one thing I say I appreciate from my grandparents, is they set forth such an amazing example of how to be. They were very large components of education, and to be educated, and to treat people fairly. I can say that my grandmother, you know, even teaching students that were not in her race, but she would always reiterate with me that to her it did not matter what their race was. They were humans first. They were part of the human race, and that was the most important thing. That's all she saw when she taught, you know, her students, and that's what she, you know, instilled in me, and that's why I instilled in my son. Even though there's so many conversations about race today, and you think our children do not hear it, you think they have no idea what it is. And so even when my son brings race to me, even I'm shocked. It's six. I said, wow, he's talking to me about race? But they're experiencing that. And so we have to keep reiterating that, you know, one, race is a social construct, and we are all part of the human race. We might have differences, whether it's socioeconomic backgrounds, educational backgrounds, cultural backgrounds, but we are very much so the same and similar, and we can learn from each other in that aspect.
In a big picture, in the here and now, you go back to Ferguson, Floyd, and recent history. Are we learning anything? Are we going forward? Is there room for optimism?
I would say, from my personal experience, Ferguson, when that happened, I just found out that I was pregnant with my son. But I did not know he was a boy yet. But I remember thinking, I said, oh my God. I said, if he's a boy, what am I going to do? And all these things are happening. Like, how am I going to raise my son? I haven't experienced that. I was only told, you know, what happened. My grandparents taught in Dunbar lots of segregation, but to carry a child and not know what's going to happen to my child. When I found out he was a boy, I said, oh my God. But I asked God to help me raise him in this world, in this society, because I had no idea. As a Black woman, I was like, I don't know how to raise a man. But how do I raise a man that society doesn't think he's dangerous? He's cute. I say, my son is so cute. And everyone says how cute he is, but I said, he's cute now. When does he stop being cute? When does he become dangerous? So it's always being conscientious. Like, history repeats itself. And I tell my students, I said, this is a movement. What's happening now is a movement, and it happened before. We know that. We look at Emmett Till. His death sparked a movement, and these are teenagers. These are college students who are going out and making this happen. And I was in college when, like, Trayvon Martin was killed. I was in college, and it was a movement began, because we could have been Trayvon. Trayvon was walking down a street that, you know, he lived on, and all he had was Skittles and tea. That could be any of us. That could be my son. When he walks outside to play, that could be him. So it's having those conversations, I think, because I'll say maybe with the election of our president, President Obama, people started believing that we were in a post-racial society, and we were not. We are not. I'll say it might appear to be, but the conversations still are not had. I always say that racism is the big white elephant that sits in the room that no one wants to talk about, and we dance around it, and no one wants to say anything, but it's the hurt, it's the brokenness that comes with it, and that everyone's really careful. Don't break the elephant. Don't do it. But we're already broken inside, and we're not speaking about what is really going on. So with Trayvon Martin, with Ferguson, I think it ignites those conversations that people have tried to push down and say that it does not exist, or it does not happen, or it's not happening, when in reality we see it. And social media, the fact that we can see it, it's one thing to hear about it. And that's what made Emmett Till's death so significant, because people could see. It could see what was done.
People, the mother did that
on purpose. Mm-hmm. And so now that we have cameras and Facebook and Instagram, we can really see. And then it becomes no longer race, I'll say. Now it becomes humanity.
Exactly.
Humanity. And so I think about George Floyd. That situation, that transcends race. And I knew it transcended race. Even before the verdict, I said, you know what? I said, I honestly believe, you know, we're humans, human beings. And I said, I believe that can be a guilty verdict, because it's beyond race. It's human to sit there and watch, you know, someone's life being taken from them. Most individuals have never seen anything like that. In such a deliberate manner. And yes, and people are constantly saying, hey, get off, what are you doing? And still nothing's being done. Now you put a face to it. You put a face to the racism, the police brutality, what you have constantly often denied and said is not true. You cannot say that anymore, because now the entire world can see that. And from there, we can begin to make the changes. You'll have those conversations, you'll have those discussions, and hopefully people can begin to reflect within themselves and see, you know, where they stand in this conversation and how they can continue to make the change as well. And so I tell my young people, keep with the movement. I'm not as young. I'm still young, but not as young. But continue to be that change. Continue to be what you want to see. And I see a change, but there's still so much work that needs to be done, because this is generational. The racism, it didn't pop up overnight. It's not going to go away overnight. And so it's the continuous conversation. Keep talking about it.
What's really interesting, a couple years ago I spent a week in Birmingham, and one of my most touching takeaways, it was the kids.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the grown-ups. They're the ones that led the charge.
Yeah.
And I think we, to this day, we need to rely on the hope that the kids will mm-hmm. step up to the plate like they did.
They always, because they see things that we don't see. You know, I think if we just get older, and it's harder for us to conceptualize things, but for some reason children, I guess because they have these new, fresh eyes on situations, they can imagine things that sometimes it's hard for adults to imagine. And so I'll take the vision of the child and let's run with it, because they do have it. And of course, always, our children are our future, but to tell them to keep dreaming and keep having those ideas and keep pushing those movements as well.
The movement is built on the backbone of our youth. Every cry, every warrior cry, came from the mouth of our babes. We have to look at what they called riots, were really massacres.
Mm-hmm.
And until it's owned that this was a massacre, not a riot.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at the cities that these are happening, off our back we go. When our ancestors were enslaved, and they had little bounty looking and searching fugitives,
mm-hmm.
they, from generation to generation, they went on to become cops. They went on to become policemen, mm-hmm. leaving from the South. They come up North with that mentality that we are nothing, with that mentality that we are ignorant, with that mentality, I dare you question me. And so we have to teach our children, male and females, how to survive when they're stopped. And they still, yeah. you know, we can't take that fear out of them. I think that will come from conversations, that will come from behavior, that will come from how they are perceived, how they are seen, and how those authoritarian figures, how they treat us, how they treat our children, and that interaction. And we have to look at our responsibility for that new frame of mind. But there must be willingness to participate. And it's also because these lynchings, new age lynchings, has been going on forever. This is nothing new. What is new is that it's in real time. You look at slavery by another name, and how many African-American males disappeared to work in mines, to work on plantations. That's a whole nother concept. Then you look at the mass incarceration. How our imprisoned black and brown men are a commodity. They are a commodity.
Well, it's compounded because it's for the for-profit. Yes,
exactly. So we have, how are we going to tear it down? How are we going to dismantle this? Or even for someone to truly understand where we're coming from. That is a whole new conversation that we have to look at. Crossing that threshold.
It's going to take a lot. But like you said, but we did not create the system. It's not going to be us that takes it down. But in the midst of the takedown, people will have to be honest. It's honest. Honesty about the history. And that's where the lines get blurred.
When we talk about our history, the first thing we hear, well, I didn't do this. Or right. You're doing white guilt. It's not about that. It's about the humanity. What does it cost to participate in humanity? What is the cost of humanitarian acts? Why is it a shame? Or why is it illegal just to show some humanity and to see each other, to have conversations? What is the fear? And I often ask myself, what is really going on? And you see so many unarmed black men just shot, killed. Is this really, I have to ask, if you are that afraid, why are you in that position?
Exactly.
If you are a coward, why are you wearing that uniform? You are not fit to serve. If every time you see a person of color, fear sets in. Where does that come from? I think some of it is a myth, honestly. I think some enjoy doing it. But I also think is what that's in their DNA. Like we are come from wounded wounds in our DNA. I also think that is in their DNA as well, to see us and fear us. They don't see a person, they see a monster. When you can shoot a child and pull weapons on children, but you are not going to do that with children of your race. You are going to pacify them. You're going to talk. You're going to embrace them. You want to break it down. You want to know what's wrong. But when it comes to ours, there's no value, no problem with putting a bullet in our children, no problem with taking their lives, because we do not matter.
It's ingrained in their system. Like if you were literally taught that, let's say, African Americans are not human, which we go back to the Three-Fifths Compromise. They weren't considered humans. The enslaved people were not considered human. I believe it's still ingrained. It's still taught. Just like certain things are taught within our community that we can link back to post-traumatic slave syndrome. I believe everyone has a bit of that. Because granted, you might not have been, your ancestors might not have been the enslaved, but they were the slaveholders. And if we think that that doesn't have an impact, or if that did not get passed down generationally, we're sorely mistaken to think that it's not. And so when you talk about the slave patrols, I mean, the police was formed out of these organizations that were, you know, made simply just to catch enslaved people. And we know the horrible things that were said, and the adjectives that are used to describe, well, we know as people, but they did not see them as that. And it's still ingrained. We see that in magazines, in the movies, in the TV shows. And I tell my students, oftentimes, some people might not have ever encountered an African-American individual in their entire lives. And their only experience with them is the TV. Whether it's the news, whether it's a television show or a music video, all of these things play a role in how we perceive each other.
Two, maybe 3 years ago, my son is a truck driver, and we, he had a toothache, so he went to the emergency room, and then we went later to Whole Foods store to get some soup, but it wasn't open early, it was on Sunday, and we were just shopping, and our buggy was right there, so this couple came and moved our cart, and my son said, wow, and so they were from India, and a lady turned, and she said, did I jump in front of you? And I said, yes. I said, but that's okay. But her husband did not turn around. He did not recognize us at all. He refused to even look back at us. And I said, wow, he does not see a young man as a truck driver. He does not see me as a woman or a mother of children or a value. Because he refused to turn around. And then my son said, she's going to get in trouble when they go home because she recognized us. And he was telling the truth. But my biggest fear was my son was getting upset. And I said, baby, I do not want you getting killed today. I do not need them to call the police. And this was on a Mother's Day. So that is my memory of Mother's Day that I had to. Because he felt like they were disrespecting their mom, his mom. And they were. But the lady did turn and apologize. But my biggest fear was them calling the police. And I'm losing my son that day. My loss. And that was my fear. That was my fear. And it was real. You know, and looking at it, and I'm thinking, God, please. And I'm crying inside. And my son looked at my face. And he said, okay, mom. But that was my fear that day, to lose my son on Mother's Day because someone refused to recognize us as human beings.
How fundamental a human condition. It's like, wow, crazy.
My last question. What is the consequence of us celebrating each other? What is the consequence of us valuing each other and seeing each other in totality? What is wrong with looking at each other as human beings, and that it's okay to be different. It's okay to have a different skin color, to talk differently, to occupy that space without having to apologize. And I constantly ask, what are the consequences of humanity? Can we get past that and let humanity live within us? Is that possible for humanity to take in us, to be at home with us? That's what I would like to see.
On that, I believe it comes down to telling people and letting them realize that, hey, we're human first. I think we focus so much on being separated, and we've been taught to be so separate that if we like another culture, then it's like we are selling out our own culture by not, you know, representing ours. But there is no cost to it. I'll say happiness. Peace and happiness, but that's too easy. That's for some reason it's too easy, and it's easier for some to hate, to look beyond the human aspect of people. It's easier for some, but for me, no. The consequences is peace and it's happiness, and to see people for who they are and not for whatever negative adjective that stereotype might place upon them. You see people for who they are, where they are.
And loving each other, supporting each other, sharing our differences, and not because you are different, devaluing each other because we are different.
Exactly.
You know, and I know I am fully broken. I know that. But I love myself. I don't need society to tell me I'm beautiful. I don't need permission for society for my existence. And I think that if we learn that from each other, then we would be in a better space.
I hate to say this. I could keep you guys here all day. What a touching moment.
My name is Robin White. I'm the superintendent here at Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site here in Little Rock, Arkansas.
I look at this as conscious conversation, so I would like to further conscious conversations.
I definitely agree as well. And my name is Courtney Bradford. I'm the curator of collections at the Mosaic Templars Cultural Center here in Little Rock. And I can be reached at courtney.bradford@arkansas.gov.
Thank you guys so much. What a touching afternoon.
Thank you.
Yeah, I love it. Thanks again. And I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Little Rock, Arkansas.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities, such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolf, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives. And Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust Preservation Initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
The underbed music in this show is performed by Little Rock's St. Mark's Baptist Church Choir.
God is for us. Start to say things, they become to be real. When you begin to speak stuff,
So whatever you get, you got folks that are sick in your family, people that are acting crazy, kids are acting crazy. You can always say, God is greater, he's bigger than any problem, any situation. Let's sing,
our God is greater.
Our God is strong.
Our God is strong.
God, you are higher.
God, you are higher than any.
Our God is healer.
Awesome in power.
Our God is greater, sir.
Our God is greater.
Our God is stronger.
God, you are higher than any other.
Our God is healer.
Our God is healer.
Awesome in power.
Awesome in power, our God.
Our God.
Our God.
One last time, say, our God is greater. Great choir, right ahead. Y'all give them a hand.